Where do we stand today, both in terms of clinical research data and also your clinical observations and practice in terms of toxicity tolerability issues by adding in durvalumab? This man sounds like he completely sailed through it. Again, I don't know when he first talked to you about it. What number would you give to a patient if they said, what's the chance I'm going to just go through this like this man did with zero problems?
Right. So we know that chemoradiation therapy has pulmonary toxicity as one of the adverse events, and that can happen up to a year, both acute pulmonary toxicity and delayed pulmonary toxicity. What was reassuring from the PACIFIC trial was we did see pulmonary toxicity, but the difference between the control arm and the durva arm was relatively modest. There wasn't a substantial increase in pulmonary toxicity with durva in the post-chemo RT setting. So I would say there's probably about a 5% higher likelihood of developing pneumonitis because of the fact that somebody receives durvalumab. And most of them tend to be grade 1 or 2 in severity, where you can manage them with steroids and supportive care and get them through that phase. So I would say it is a risk that patients and physicians should be aware of, but the benefits clearly outweigh those risks.
You know, in the metastatic setting, it sounds like there are situations where people are not really sure, oncologists are not really sure whether or not they're dealing with pulmonary toxicity from a checkpoint inhibitor, disease progression, cardiorespiratory disease from smoking-related problems or age, et cetera. What about in the locally advanced setting? Are there any issues in differentiating, for example, radiation pneumonitis from durvalumab pneumonitis?
I don't think we can clearly use either radiographic or clinical criteria to distinguish one from the other. They both have similar time frames in the post-chemo RT setting. I think it's just one question where you start treating them with steroids, and if the pneumonitis is not severe enough, then you can re-challenge them with durvalumab. If you have a grade 3 pneumonitis, I would just stop. It doesn't matter whether they got it from durva or from the fact that they got RT prior to starting durva.
How do you monitor patients during that year or durvalumab, and do you look, for example, at thyroid function preemptively?
We've gotten used to checking thyroid function on patients getting PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors from the metastatic setting. So I do the same thing with durva during that year of therapy. Besides that, I don't specifically go looking for any other abnormalities other than we get scans on those patients typically every quarter or every 4 months. And we keep an eye on the scans and what's happening to the pulmonary parenchyma in those scans.
One of the issues that comes up, I'm not sure exactly how often it is, but you know, we talk about it in different disease states where checkpoint inhibitors are used, are patients with prior autoimmune diseases, and sometimes patients who've had kidney transplants or other kinds of transplants. And usually this is in the metastatic setting, whether it's melanoma or whatever, you know, where you really don't have much choice, whereas here it's really kind of really adjuvant therapy. I don't know, have you had any patients with Crohn's disease or other autoimmune conditions? And if you did, how would you approach the decision about durvalumab in this setting?
Autoimmune disease as a background history for the patient is a concern when we consider starting them on immune checkpoint inhibitors. My initial approach is if they have active autoimmune disease that has required systemic therapy, I would not start those patients on PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor. Now, I've had occasional situations, I'm talking more in the metastatic, not as much in the stage 3 setting, where somebody said, I've had Crohn's disease 20 years ago, I've not had any activity over 20 years. I weigh the benefit versus risk, how bad is their lung cancer, and whether I really need the PD-1 to help them. And in occasional situations, when I run out of options, I might re-challenge them with PD-1 inhibition. In the transplant setting, post-transplant setting, I certainly would not use a PD-1 inhibitor outside of a center where there's a lot of experience and teams to monitor autoimmune or rejection events very quickly and be able to monitor for that.